Welcome to How I Raised It, the podcast that goes behind the scenes with entrepreneurs who've raised capital. We uncover the tips, tricks, and techniques they use to get investors to write a check. Strap in and turn it up.
Hi, welcome to another episode of How I Raised It, produced by Foundersuite.com. Today I have Hjalmar Nordegren, CEO of Karma, coming to us from Stockholm, Sweden. It's already evening there. How's your day been, Hjalmar?
Thank you. Pleasure being on your show. And my evening's been great so far, and my day as well. So yeah, I've had a hectic but good one.
Well, great. Let's just go right to it. So what is Karma? What do you guys do?
So Karma is a platform where restaurants and grocery stores can sell their surplus food to consumers. It's a quite straightforward value proposition. We help take care of your food waste, and we give you more revenue, more foot traffic, and we also make sure that great food isn't wasted. It ends up in the hands of hungry people instead.
And so how does it work? A restaurant signs on with you, and then at the end of, does this all happen kind of at the end of the day? At the end of the day, whatever's left, they can sell through your app, or?
Yeah, in the beginning, it starts by the end of the day. So, I mean, if you look at the typical restaurant, if you will, I believe they sign on to our platform thinking like, you know what, every now and then we have, you know, one salad standing alone in the shelf when we close shop. So maybe 30 minutes before closing, they will upload that salad to Karma. It's like the first time you upload something, it takes around a minute. If you do it a second time, you're literally only specifying quantity, like two salads or three salads, and it ends up taking less time to actually put it on the platform than to throw it away. And what's interesting is that they sort of learn to predict their food waste. Like food waste in itself, while we have like physical stores and not sort of pre-booked lunches for everyone, it's quite inevitable because you can't really tell exactly how many people are going to come through your door. So think of Karma almost like a buffer for a restaurant. So we are there when you see that you're not selling everything that you produce today. So like you choose the day before how much meat you're going to defrost, for instance. And yeah, once you've defrosted that, you don't want to put that back in the freezer. So when it actually sort of, you know, rains the next day, you might say, oh, I should have defrosted less. But there's where Karma comes in and helps you really sort of, you know, make sure that everything is put to good use instead.
Yeah, interesting. I know how hard it is to predict. This past weekend, my kids' school does their big annual Italian Day bazaar, and I worked the grill serving Italian sausages for 8 hours, probably a few thousand. And of course, we had some left over at the end, which we just donated. But I, you know, it gave me the feel of how hard it is to predict exact demand for something really perishable. So totally makes sense.
Yeah. That's an impressive amount of Italian sausages.
It was impressive. It was a lot. It was fun. So does this ever like cannibalize? I mean, do people start to wait until there's surplus before they actually buy? Could it ever like impact the sales in sort of a negative way in that like, you know, consumers are going to wait until they can get it cheaper. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's what most people think, right? I mean, that's what literally every restaurant that we pitched to when we started a couple of years back, that's what everyone told us. So, yeah. Because everyone was afraid it was going to cannibalize on their ordinary business. But I think it sort of takes care of itself in the platform, because what happens is like, since you can't predict food waste, like some days you'll have a lot, some days you'll have none.
Yeah.
So as a consumer, there is way more demand for this than there is supply, which is actually, it might not sound like a good thing, but it's actually helping the entire model. So let's say that we have, you know, a couple of thousands of meals in Stockholm, where we're sitting right now, every day. But when we look at the number of users in the platform, there's like, you know, almost up to 100,000 users here. Mm-hmm. And I mean, Stockholm is a small city, so it's actually a significant amount of users compared to Stockholm size. So what's interesting is that there will never be enough supply for you to secure your lunch or dinner every day on the platform. Instead, you would be following your, you know, top three favorite locations in Karma, and you might hope that something pops up. But the good thing is that even if it pops up, there's not a guarantee that you will get it. I mean, it's first come, first serve, right? So a lot of days you're going to get what you want. Some days you're going to try something new and find a new place. And a lot of other days you're going to say like, oh, I didn't find what I wanted today. But that's part of the entire model.
Yes.
So it's sort of the chance that you might get the ultimate meal, right? Really your favorite meal at a discounted price. That would be the best outcome, but it can't be guaranteed. So you're actually, what ends up happening is that every location in Karma has, you know, 10,000 followers plus after some time in the app. And when you then upload, you know, 20 meals as that restaurant, you're still going to have 9,980 people that saw your brand name that weren't able to save something from you that day, but that still might now consider going there and, you know, buy a regular dinner.
Yeah, that's brilliant. So it's not just getting rid of your excess waste, but it's a marketing channel for them as well. That's cool.
It's like a positive side effect of taking care of your waste.
Yeah. And I bet there's, you know, the same kind of reward center in the brain that slot machines in Las Vegas do, right? When you're following your favorite restaurant and, you know, every other week you win the meal you've been wanting, there must be like a real strong endorphin rush.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I mean, it feels really good to actually, you know, rescue something that you really also wanted from your favorite restaurant. That's a great feeling. But it's also one really fun thing that we've sort of found ourselves doing was you're opening the app to see, you know, your favorite restaurants and what they have. And even if they don't have what you're looking for, it's actually a surprising amount of restaurants that have a lot of nice stuff. So you end up saying like, oh, I didn't plan on going past this restaurant today, but, you know, now that I've saved something, I might go here. I've never been here before. So it's actually working out as quite the discovery tool as well for a lot of people.
Very smart. And then on the supermarket side, is it similar, kind of same model? Like they have things that are expiring soon and they put them up, or is it totally different?
Yeah, so we basically replace the, depending on which country you're in, but the red or yellow label system. So people will sort of mark up items in grocery stores to say, here's an item at a discounted price, but you have to like stand in front of that shelf to be able to take part of that deal, if you will. Whereas we're saying, let's increase the probability that we sort of push the items with a short expiry date so that we can consume them instead of saying, oh, not everything was picked up today. So it works exactly the same way. You can filter for groceries if that's what you're looking for. And there's a surprising amount of people that actually starts their grocery shopping through Karma by finding, you know, the base ingredients for what they will eat, you know, in the evening after work.
Yeah. Great. Such a great idea. And it's actually beautiful, beautifully simple too. I know it's probably not simple in execution, but beautifully simple. So where did you come up with this? How did you come up with this? What were you doing before starting this? Yeah.
Try to make a long story short. I've been programming since the age of 13 and always done like projects on the side, you know, like fun projects, IT stuff, and studied far out of my field. So I studied medicine at Karolinska Institutet here in Sweden. And during my university time at Karolinska, I actually created this project that was a surveying platform that I did for a client, but that turned out to become almost like its own entity. So I brought in a couple of friends, brought in one of my best friends from upper secondary school, as it's called, I believe in English, who joined that sort of survey project. He and I sort of set up this journey that we were going to build the next big thing. And for a long time, we thought it was the serving platform. And we had that as a part-time job outside of our university studies. And after a couple of years of that, when we both graduated, we sat down and said, like, is this what we want to do? Like, if we go full on into entrepreneurship, is it surveying from this sort of platform that grew from a project that we did for fun back in the days? And at this time, we had also hired a guy named Mattis, who was our CTO at that time. So the three of us sort of sat down and said, is this what we want to do? Mm-hmm. And we started to think, like, no, we probably want to do something more impactful, like a consumer product, because we had done business to business for years. And, you know, as an early stage entrepreneur, we thought that, oh, we're done with this now. We would have made it by now. We were kind of naive in how long time it takes to build something good. Yeah. But that led us to the revelation that we needed to do something about it. So we actually started, you know, brainstorming what to do next. And as we were doing that, we met our fourth co-founder. So we're four co-founders. And her name is Elsa, and she had just sold her previous company, Pop Fruits, which was a frozen fruit on a stick company. It was sort of a healthy alternative to ice cream. Mm-hmm. She just sold that to a British company. So the four of us came together from pretty, you know, different backgrounds. And we have all studied different things at university. But we still had this common vision of building like the next big thing. And we all wanted it to be a consumer product. So we actually started out building, we said, like, what is the sort of prime psychological combiner for people? What works for everyone? And we said that deals is sort of a universally liked thing, right? So we wanted to build a deal platform early on. So imagine the karma as we just described it, but for everything. It wasn't just food waste. It was just flash sales of everything, mm-hmm. clothes, food. And it actually worked really great for a while. So we had a lot of users that we were sort of a crowdsourced version of Groupon, as sort of cliche as that sounds. Our users both found deals on town, uploaded it to the Karma platform, and other users were sitting at home looking at these crowdsourced deals and, you know, claiming them. But we didn't really have a good product market fit with this. So we could see that we got a lot of users that downloaded the app. They were excited, but they didn't really understand how to use it. So we said, we need to make it simpler. It can't be like hundreds of different deals. Like, how will we find the right deal for the right person? That's, you know, if Netflix has trouble choosing the right movie for you, how could we ever, you know, filter that massive amount of data? And then we said, we need to narrow it down. We need to make it much, much simpler. And we saw a restaurant that actually uploaded their surplus food onto our platform as, you know, one of the deals on there. And it got us intrigued, because we said, like, well, if this restaurant is doing it, like, why wouldn't all restaurants do this? Like, isn't this like a logical problem? Once you hear it, it sounds kind of like, yeah, that should work.
Yeah.
And we started to look into this and saw that one third of all food in the world is wasted, which we thought was, you know, appalling and just a crazy high number. And the more we looked into it, we saw that the more developed a country is, the more food they waste. So in the US, there were studies where it ranged from 40, even up to 50% of all food produced is wasted. And we said, like, wait, so it's literally going in the wrong direction. So the more technologically advanced we become, the worse we are at this. So when we sort of sat down and just overnight decided, like, we have the platform to solve this problem. This is very much in line with when we started out, what we wanted to build. So it almost felt like coming home, like finding the sort of mission that we had all been longing for a very long time. That wasn't that deal platform. It was this.
Yeah, that's great. It's great. And so you're in Sweden and London to date. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. And soon in more countries near you.
Okay.
So I can't divulge any super secret information as of today, but it's we're definitely looking at expanding. We did a funding round this summer, and we're going to put that capital to good use and make sure that Karma is available in a lot more places soon.
Cool. Yeah, I want to talk about the recent round, but let's go back actually to the first days after you've kind of centered on this this idea and locked down on it. How did you guys finance it? I think I saw an accelerator in your history and a seed round. How did you fund it?
So that was, it's actually quite interesting. So both the accelerator, which is called Sting here in Stockholm, and the angel round that we did was sort of the pre-food waste days. It was in the with the old platform. And when we sat down, because we could sort of see that the metrics weren't going to, you know, take off anytime soon. They were trending well, all right, but they were not sort of fantastic. So we sat down and we decided to go into food waste, and then we pitched this to our existing investors. And I probably remember this the wrong way, but I don't think we got a super positive response from them. Like, some of them were like, yeah, if that's what you believe, then go for it. Some others were, you know, pretty annoyed with us that we shifted directions like that. And they were like, oh, this was a waste of money. Like, we shouldn't have invested in this. But that was actually like, I remember being so frustrated back then and so angry that, you know, you almost felt like, oh, this, I was betrayed. I don't have the support from the people I thought would support us in this. But that turned out to be one of the greatest drivers for us going forward, because I remember us sitting down and saying, like, you know, we're going to show them how wrong they are. We're going to really give it all. So I think we got an extra power boost from that. So I don't regret at all them saying that. On the contrary, I think it was very helpful to us.
That's interesting. I mean, I have a perception, which may be completely wrong, but that, you know, Nordic investors are fairly conservative. Do you think that has any factor in kind of their reluctance to support the pivot, or is it just a case specific, you know, type of thing?
That's an interesting standpoint. I'm not sure I agree that they're conservative. I think that there are a lot of funds that are conservative, absolutely, but there's an equal amount of funds, I would say, that are very progressive and tries to, you know, find the next Spotify or the next Skype, or really invest broadly. But you might call that conservative, but there's, you know, there's always these like macro trends that everyone seems to follow, right? Like, a year ago was blockchain, and probably still is. And you know, now it's anything that has AI in it, like, money is there, you know. So it's but I don't think that's very different from what we've seen in the US pitching. So it might be us like being young in the whole funding game, but I don't think Sweden and the US funds are that different, actually.
Yeah. Okay. That's good to know. Yeah. I think it's a friend of mine, Nikolai Wadstrom, who runs now a fund here, Bootstrap Labs. And I've heard him kind of complain about Swedish investors, but he was doing a startup many years ago. So maybe it's kind of changed, especially with Spotify and others. Anyway. Okay. So interesting.
I think for every unicorn that sort of came out of Sweden, it sort of accelerated the entire ecosystem. I think it started back with Skype, right? It literally raised the bar for everyone that was in entrepreneurship and set new standards for what you could achieve as a Swedish entrepreneur. Yeah. I think like now Spotify and Klarna and a lot of others have done the same.
Absolutely. Okay. So after this pivot, or kind of focus, I guess you could call it, then you went and raised an early round, and I'm looking at like eVentures. Tell us maybe about that. Did you have some pretty good traction, or were you pitching this idea of this food waste concept?
No. So that's when we started to get like real product market fit in the Swedish market. I mean, we weren't anywhere near launching in a second market yet, but we could see that it organically spread, not just with the demand side, but also on the supply side. We could see that it sort of spread inside Sweden to new Swedish cities. We could see this like, it was, I think, and I mean, most big things are built by accident, right? So, I mean, I think we did something right, both with the product and the brand in combination. We had a lot of like, you know, iterations internally where we tried a bunch of different things. And then suddenly there was like this aha moment where we found like, oh, so this is the balance that we need to strike. And then it sort of started to organically grow much faster. And at that time we realized like, oh, so now to be able to take the next step, we would literally need to invest in more growth. So we would either, you know, sit on our hands and wait for the revenue to start, you know, so we could expand using that, or we could say, look, we're going to get there and who'd like to fund this instead? That was actually quite an interesting round for us. I don't think we were that prepared to actually do a round. I think that was very much, I don't want to say we winged it. We prepared a presentation and we thought we were, you know, structured in the way we were doing it. But looking at now that we've raised the Series A, we definitely weren't structured in the same way. But yeah, we sort of created a list of people that we wanted to meet. We went through that list. I don't think we did a super incredible job of pitching ourselves and or like what metrics to front. And you learn, it was very much like running the startup. You learn on the job. So as we were pitching, we realized like, oh, we should say this instead, or we should do this differently.
Yeah.
And then we met with eVentures from Germany, who it was a really, really great meeting. So I mean, I remember they calling us up and we had a chat on the phone first, and then they said they would come visit, and they just, one, showed this really great interest, and two, they inherently understood what it is we're trying to build all the way back then. So even though there was super early days, we didn't have the traction that we have today, we still managed to somehow convey to them that, like, imagine the possibilities that this can sort of take on. And they're one of the few investors that I think tried very hard to sort of understand how we were thinking. And I'm really, really impressed with the way they do their investments.
Great. Yeah, interesting. So that early VC round, how many investors did you talk to, and were you only focused on European seed VCs, or how did you kind of focus the list?
Yeah, so this was only European seed, I would say. I think we might have sort of reached a little bit higher to some funds that were like, no, you guys are way too early. But that was more of like us not really knowing the landscape. I don't remember how many funds we talked to. It was probably, you know, 15 or 17 or something like that. It wasn't like a massive amount of funds. I don't think we really understood how it works back then. We thought we were doing a great process. And in hindsight, I mean, the outcome was as favorable as we would ever wish for. I mean, again, like I can't stress enough how sort of a lucky meet it was for eVentures to reach out to us for an initial meeting. And it turned out like they timed that reach out perfectly. And one of the funniest memories from that round was when a guy from eVentures, Jonathan, he came to Sweden to meet us, and he was going to try the car map for the first time. And we said like, yeah, so we only made it available in Sweden. He got to borrow my phone, bought, I think, a cinnamon bun on the platform from a nearby cafe. It was after lunch. And right before he was going to catch his flight, we went down there to pick it up. So he got the phone. He walked inside, and we could see like there was something going on inside. We were standing outside and just looking in. Something was going on inside. And it turned out that the other two people inside that bakery that he was saving food from They were also there buying Karma food, and they sort of jumped him, which is very non-Swedish to do. They jumped him and they're like, oh, you're here with Karma as well. Isn't this the best platform? So they basically like harassed him on the platform. And when he came out, you could see that he was skeptical. Like, did you plant these people here?
Right, right.
And that was, it was just like a hilarious moment. We were obviously super excited that someone was talking about Karma. And so we were just, you know, over the moon. And you could see sort of like Jonathan trying to assess, like, was this a plant? Like,
yeah.
Did they do this? Well, we really did it, and it was still one we sort of joke about it today.
That's a great story. Well, it is amazing how many, you know, times it just comes down to kind of being lucky at the right time, and you know, having things happen like that. That's great. Making a good product helps, right?
Yeah. I mean, they will have to speak for themselves, but I hope it wasn't the people in the bakery that was the driver behind the investment. I hope that they had sort of decided already, and that was hopefully just you know, an extra push.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask, and you kind of started to answer this, but how did you get in touch with these early seed funds? It sounds like eVentures reached out to you. How did they find you, and how did you get in touch with the other folks?
To be fair, I actually don't remember if we reached out to eVentures or they reached out to us. Mm. It might actually be them reaching out to us, or it might be the other way around. I don't remember. I could probably look it up. I think it was a combination of, you know, a couple of them were contacts that you've nurtured over the last couple of months, either where funds had reached out to us, and we sort of kept that conversation going and just saying like, you know what, let's meet next month. And then like, oh no, we're not fundraising yet. Let's try to reschedule for the month after that, and so on. Some of them were just, you know, asking our angel investors if they were able to make an intro. Most of the time, I don't think they were able to make, you know, a game-changing intro. Sometimes they had like the right contact at the right fund, but it still didn't sort of pan out to be the right investor for that round. We really wanted to find an investor that understood what it was that we were trying to build, and we were pretty bullish on that.
Yeah.
So I would say it was probably like 50% coming from like previously nurtured contacts, and 50% was basically cold outreach from us.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, that's always a question first-time founders have, is like, how do I build a network if I don't have it? How much of the work is cold outreach versus like nurturing? So that's kind of a good baseline metric to to have there.
Yeah.
Great. So let's fast forward to the most recent round. So congratulations. It sounds like a $12 million Series A led by Bessemer, correct?
Led by Kinnevik, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, so Bessemer has a stake in that round, which is great. And we're really like amazed by them and their team, and really happy that they wanted to come in this early. But yeah, Kinnevik led the round, and Kinnevik is a sort of Swedish, well-known VC.
Awesome. So metrics are tracking. So just kind of go through the thought process and the process itself of raising this round. Things are going well, and you just decide it's time to kind of scale and ramp up. And how did you identify the right investor partners for the A?
It was actually quite difficult because we basically plan to raise this fall or in the winter, but we had metrics trending the right way. So we said like most of our metrics are pretty early. Like we still had a lot of money in the bank, so we could have gone on for another, you know, 7, 8, 9 months probably without raising. But we said like, you know, metrics are trending the right way. Maybe if we go out now, even though most people will likely say that you're too early to raise this kind of round, we might be able to say, you know, we know that we're early, but you can see how this is trending. Trust us, this is going to sort of turn out well in the end, which I guess is something that every entrepreneur probably tries to pitch. Yeah, it was kind of an opportunist move from our end, and we basically said, let's go for it. And I mean, you can't sort of semi fundraise, you have to go all in, right? So that's what we did, 6 months earlier than we expected.
Yeah. When did you start the round?
I think we started it mid-April, something like that. But I mean, again, like you, after last round, you realize like you never stop fundraising. So I think this time around, it was even more, contacts that we've been nurturing over time and meeting sporadically for a coffee sometime or over dinner when we were in London or in New York. So it was, I would say there was a lot more warm leads this time around.
Awesome. And then I see Electrolux on the cap table, which I remember Electrolux as being like a vacuum cleaner producer from a long time ago. I don't know if they're still in the US or not, but
they are.
Okay. How'd they get in the deal?
So it's quite an interesting story, and we're actually doing an announcement together with them next week. So I can't disclose too much, but so what happened was that they reached out for completely different reasons and said, hey, we're looking to see if there's any sort of cool partnerships that we can do with startups, and like, we're experts in the food business. You guys are experts in the food waste business. Could we do something together? So it started off as a collaboration project that sort of, you know, grew and grew, and we got to know their team. They got to know ours. And it's difficult to sort of tell half the story, but we ended up doing some really cool stuff together that we're going to announce pretty soon. And that ultimately led to the investment as well.
Interesting. And then I see Bessemer again on there, and that's your Silicon Valley VC. So how did you get in with them, or how did they find you?
Bessemer, just trying to remember, it was actually, I think it was someone at Bessemer who, one of our investors connected us to someone at Bessemer, and we went to do an initial meeting with them. And, you know, for us, it was sort of an opportunist move. We thought that, you know, we're this European company or this Nordic company even, and maybe they won't have any interest in investing in us and at this stage. And they made it sort of clear that like we might not be the, you know, perfect fit for a US VC even, which is true. I mean, most US VCs were like, so like, tell me when you're coming here, right? That's what they wanted to know. And can't disclose when we're going there either. But I mean, ultimately, Bessemer had a really sort of thorough process where they were super diligent and also very thorough in for the lack of a better word, like in the entire process. And we were really impressed by them and sort of got that same feeling as with eVentures, that they understood inherently what it was we were trying to build. Mm-hmm. I have to say, like talking to a lot of VCs, like it's, I understand that there must be so many deals that, you know, flow through in their everyday lives, but it's just super refreshing to see someone really engaging with what it is, like trying to put themselves in our shoes and say like, so what are we trying to build here? Almost hear them, you know, pitch the vision that we are always pitching. But I think it's a bold one, so it's really nice for a change when you get it, you know, bounced back to you and they say like, so this is what it is you're trying to do. And you're like, yes, finally. Yes, that's what we're trying to do.
We all just want to be understood, right?
yeah.
We get it. Yeah. Good.
Yeah. So it was a really, really good process, very professional, and almost a sort of, you know, a rerun of the feeling we got from eVentures. So that was fantastic.
That's interesting. So kind of riffing on this a little bit more, like it's kind of interesting. I was in Turkey 2 weeks ago meeting with some startups. Yesterday did a session for some Brazilian startups. Tonight I'm going to some French startups, and all these guys are trying to figure out, like, how do I kind of crack the US market to raise money? And so you've got one foot in the market with Bessemer. Any other tips or just even thoughts on, like, as a foreign European company, on how to kind of approach, like, Silicon Valley investors? Any tips or thoughts?
Be American. But I think European people are inherently sort of timid when it comes to funding. Like, you don't want to say, like, we can do this. But I think US or Americans are much more confident in their ability to execute. And I think as a European, you have to sort of step up and say, like, hey, we can do this. And then sort of be very, very confident in that messaging. That's a bit of what made it work, I believe. And one thing that we haven't mentioned, like, there's another Silicon Valley fund, Rocketship VC, that also invested in this round.
Okay.
That reached out to us based on their algorithm. So they found us, like, literally at the exact moment we were going to start doing outreach, and they ended up investing in the end. They've also been really, really great with their process and just, you know, fantastic in their support in all of this. So I would say for the US investors, it's like being more bold than to the European investors. Without, of course, acting arrogantly or you still need to be humble. But less so than in Europe. What else? I think you need to have, like, a plan of attack to, like, if you're not going to the US tomorrow, when are you going there and how are you going there? Mm-hmm. There's tons of companies that have European companies that have gone to the US. So, like, there's all of these, like, fantastic resources out there that you can reach out to and say, like, hey, I would love to buy you lunch if you can tell me how you entered the US and, like, what were your biggest learnings? And we've done that with everything. I mean, at Karma, we're so nerdy about, like, trying to figure out, like, what is the sort of framework here? And that definitely goes with the US as well. Like, how would we crack the US the day we go into that market? That's been a very important point for us to bring with us into those meetings.
No, that's good. Do you actually build, like, a formal advisory board with some, say, Swedish founders in the US, or is it more informal, having calls, conversations, coffees?
For the learnings, I would say it's more informal. I can't speak for other European countries, but it's worked really well for, like, you know, a Swedish company talking to another Swedish company. That worked fantastically well. We've also talked to a lot of companies that aren't Swedish. That's been super helpful. Where you're, like, if you've got enough grit to sort of harass people long enough, then they will eventually, hopefully, sit down with you.
Yeah.
Or block your email. I don't know. I mean, both of them is an outcome, right? So you've made progress in some way. Really be persistent to get the information that you think you need to raise.
Have enough grit to harass people long enough so that they eventually either sit down with you or block you. I love it. That's paraphrasing, but that's a great tip.
That can definitely be used out of context, but I can probably still stand by it if someone throws that back at me.
Oh, very good. All right. One or two more questions. I'll let you go. But what's the startup scene in Sweden these days? Is it pretty healthy? Are there any, like, particular trends or industries or sectors that are hot? And any maybe I'll ask it this way too. Any resources for any like Swedish entrepreneurs that are listening to this that they should kind of look at or check out or groups to join, stuff like that?
That's a good question. I mean, if there are any Swedish entrepreneurs or Swedish VCs listening to this, they'll probably think that I don't know what I'm talking about, which is that might be true. But I can only tell you my view of the Swedish ecosystem. It's really healthy and it's booming. I mean, like I mentioned before, the sort of Skype set it all off when they sold. So
yeah.
I think that sort of created a wave of new startups, and we got the Spotify's, the Klarna's, the iSettles, and a lot of others. And I think now that they're going public and they're selling and everything, which like literally happened this year, I think we're going to see another wave, but now we have like, you know, 3x the initial wave at least. So I think that Sweden is just going to, you know, be even more startup-y. And I mean, I've been to Silicon Valley a couple of times, San Francisco, I've been to New York, and I have to say like the Swedish startup scene is actually standing pretty strong, even in comparison to you guys.
Great.
And not that we're, you know, at that scale, not at all, but I would definitely say density wise, it's Sweden is a small country, right? But it's, we do have sort of a strong belief in entrepreneurship, and there is a lot of sort of both willpower and access to capital and access to knowledge here in Sweden that makes it fairly easy to start your own business and, you know, try out your idea.
Here we have, of course, the PayPal mafia that all became investors and a few other waves like that. Are you seeing like a Skype mafia of angels or Spotify mafia of angels that are doing a lot of investing?
Yeah, I mean, we are. I mean, I don't know if there's a Skype mafia. There probably is, but I'm not aware. But, you know, Niklas Zennström, who's running Atomico, I mean, he's from Skype. And I mean, it's he's definitely, you know, set the bar very high for Sweden, which is fantastic. I mean, he's inspired a lot of entrepreneurs. And I've heard like, you know, senior entrepreneurs inside these new unicorns that are talking about like what Zennström meant to them.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're seeing the same thing. Like there's a lot of new entrepreneurs that look up to the Klarna people or the Spotify people and saying like, oh, I want to build that someday. And I know that they're actively engaging into, you know, building the Swedish startup scene and making sure that that's high on the both political and sort of operational agenda for what we do here. So yeah, there's a lot of reinvesting. I'm not going to draw comparisons to the PayPal mafia because they obviously did a fantastic job reinvesting in the startup community. But I think we're seeing something similar here in Sweden.
Okay, last question. Any other tips you would like to share with listeners or anything you would do differently, you know, if you started this all over again?
Started this all over again as in fundraising or the business part, building
either,
something?
Either's fine. Both are, yeah. Anything really?
This is always super difficult. I don't know if my advice applies to someone else running a business. I would like, I think it's very true what everyone says. Like it all comes down to grit, persistence. Like, I mean, I can't count on my fingers how many times people have said that we're never going to make it. We're going to fail, both, you know, friends and family and investors and complete strangers. And you just have to sort of, you need to be able to turn that into fuel instead of, you know, brakes. That's one thing. And the other thing is like, don't underestimate the power of people. This is probably also a super cliche thing to say, but I just know personally, I've always said like, it's the operational part that's important for me as a founder. And the sort of longer we've been in this business, even with like the several ventures behind me, I feel more and more that it all comes down to what people you're able to inspire to join you on the journey. Like you can never build the next amazing thing by yourself. And I'm not saying that to sort of challenge someone. There's probably some person out there that can do it, but it's more of a general principle. Like you're going to need everyone's your enemy at some point when you grow your business, and you're going to need a lot of friends on the journey. Don't underestimate how much time you should spend on finding the right people.
Yeah, those are good. Okay, I like it. I like the turning the nose into either fuel or brakes. That's kind of a cool metaphor. Good stuff. So if people want to learn more, it's just karma.life, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Great. And anything you want to plug, promote, open job recs, or should they just check out your website?
Move to Sweden, maybe. It's a great country. Spend a year here and you'll never regret it.
Yeah, I took my family to Norway this summer. It's not Sweden. It's different, of course. I know it's different countries, but love the Nordics. It's just beautiful up there and the quality of life seems great. So I'd be a fan of doing that. Yeah,
Sweden is small. So if anyone from the startup community is ever in Stockholm, ping me and I'll show you the Swedish archipelago.
Cool. Great. I might take you up on that someday. So
please do. I'd be happy to.
Awesome. All right, Hjalmar, this is really fun. Good stuff. I look forward to, you kind of hinted at it. I won't, give anything away because I don't know anything, but I look forward to trying this app out. I'm totally your target customer. I love getting a deal and I'm a foodie. This is like made for me. So I can't wait till you make your way to San Francisco. So this sounds great.
Make sure you can use it soon.
Okay. Ooh, that'd be cool. All right. I'll keep an eye out. Maybe I'll set a Google alert or something.
please do.
All right, Hjalmar, thank you so much. And we'll catch you after your next round. Okay.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.